Jameson, as many people in this space may have seen, you wrote an article about fake Bitcoin. And from what I understand, the inspiration for that article partially sprung from a tweet the other day in which you said that Bitcoin would struggle to be a store of value if everyone bought fake Bitcoin. What did you mean by that? And how did it form the inspiration for your article?
Right. So at the time, I think I tweeted that when the balance sheet of FTX became a revelation, and that I think they had something like 17,000 Bitcoin and liabilities and basically 0 to 1 Bitcoin and actual assets. And at the time, that was a straightforward way of thinking, these scammers are selling, quote unquote, Bitcoin to unsuspecting rubes who are, they're buying IOUs just like you would on any other exchange. But of course, unbeknownst to them, there's no actual Bitcoin to back it. And, we've been having a lot of interesting debates recently around proof of reserves and, withdrawing from exchanges. And once I sat down, I really started thinking about it and doing some more research because, I pay attention to Caitlin Long, and she's been harping on this for many years of, the dangers of rehypothecation. With all of the contagion and credit risk that has been spreading over the past few months, it became clear, I think, that the rehypothecation issue has become much bigger. And then even I was looking beyond that, I was looking at what may become a potential problem in the future with basically these quote-unquote paper Bitcoin contracts and the it's really, Wall Street shenanigans that have been happening for decades. And, I think this is something that we just need to keep our eyes on because it's already begun. It just seems to be a very small volume at the moment, but it's definitely something worth keeping an eye on. And I think that we are uniquely positioned to fight back against it, unlike the gold and silver bugs.
Awesome. And so, if you were going to try and define fake Bitcoin in a sentence or two, what would you describe fake Bitcoin versus real Bitcoin?
Yeah, so I mean, real Bitcoin is a cryptographic token that you control the keys to and that you can verify is following the rules of the protocol. So, this is one of the reasons why my article ended up being so lengthy, as a lot of my articles do. But you can look around and say, there are many different things out there that are being sold as Bitcoin. But if for one reason or the other, you can't deposit that, into a wallet that you can verify yourself, then it's not real Bitcoin. Then, you can get into deeper distinctions around whether it even has the potential to be real Bitcoin. And there were some things that I didn't even touch on in the article. Like I didn't even go down the rabbit hole of all the different wrapped Bitcoin assets that are out there.
That's a good point. One of the things that you spoke about were knockoffs, i.e. cheap imitations of Bitcoin. By this, correct me if I'm wrong, you mean, say, competing networks that purport to be Bitcoin?
Exactly. I mean, this was a problem really in the 2017 to maybe 2019 era. And at least from a market perspective, the threat of fork coins that purport to be the quote unquote real Bitcoin, it seems to have died off over the past few years and people have moved on to other things. I certainly say that, the different flavors of wrapped Bitcoin probably have much higher market cap now than even the aggregate value of all of those fork coins. And this is where it starts to get really complicated because I think there's probably at least half a dozen different types of wrapped Bitcoin, and some of them are ostensibly higher quality than others. But, as part of the fallout of this whole recent FTX Alameda debacle, I think it was discovered that I don't even know how to pronounce it, but the like Solana-based wrapped Bitcoin essentially was completely unbacked and, it's worthless. I think the exchange rate on that dropped by like 90%+ once that revelation came out.
It's an excellent point. And then another aspect of fake Bitcoin that you touched on, and perhaps you spent the most time on, were IOUs. For those that aren't familiar with an IOU, perhaps someone that isn't, say, a native English speaker, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, it basically means that you have been given some sort of coupon, you know, a token, not necessarily a cryptographic token, but some sort of database entry or other, you know, centralized digital asset that says that some counterparty owes you a quote unquote real Bitcoin. And, you know, essentially this is what happens whenever you go to a centralized exchange or a broker and you press buy, is, you know, they're executing essentially a database update on their end after it goes through their matching engine. And, you know, you don't receive Bitcoin. You have to then take another step after that to actually withdraw that coupon, you know, into real Bitcoin on the Bitcoin network. I guess to kind of shill Casa for a second, you know, we do have a buy integration, and that, while it's not, you know, real time, instantaneous, in a few seconds receive Bitcoin, the sort of automatic result of that is that, you know, it sends you an on-chain transaction. Like, there is no second step that you have to take to get your real Bitcoin.
Awesome. Okay. And then you in the article, which I've posted in the space, you can find it either in the comments section or above. You talked a little bit about the relationship between supply and demand and how real Bitcoin and fake Bitcoin interact with this. How does fake Bitcoin affect the price?
Yeah, this is where I start to get uncomfortable and outside of my wheelhouse, because I'm not a economist or financial expert. But I think the closest thing that you can start looking into is all of the shenanigans that have happened in the gold and silver markets over the years. And really the main takeaway that I had is that when you start creating markets that are based on IOUs and you're trading these IOUs that may be fractionally backed or maybe almost completely unbacked, in the case of, for example, cash settled futures markets, then the trading volume on those things can be completely disconnected from reality, because they don't have to actually physically deliver the asset. You're creating this completely disconnected market that becomes a lot easier to manipulate, because you don't necessarily have the risk that, you know, you'll end up on the bad side of a trade and end up having to physically deliver an asset that you don't have. It's quite literally a fiat market. You know, you're trading these tokens that they may be called gold, they may be called silver, they may be called Bitcoin, but it's really fiat under the hood.
Well said. And you also framed this fake Bitcoin issue from the aspect of securing scarcity. What do you mean by securing it?
Well, I think we all know how the 21 million Bitcoin cap is insured, and I've written extensively about how that works from a technical standpoint with, you know, running the nodes and basically validating all of the rules of the protocol, which in aggregate ensure that no one is creating Bitcoin at a rate faster than everyone agrees upon. But the kind of weird rabbit hole that I ended up going down here is that, you know, we're essentially creating these layers on top of Bitcoin. And when you talk about layered Bitcoin, most people start thinking about things like Lightning and side chains and things that are, you know, actual cryptographic layers. But you could also think of, you know, second layer Bitcoin as being all of these centralized custodians that, you know, they're building on the Bitcoin technology stack. They're writing applications on top of Bitcoin, and then other people are interfacing with that. And so what kind of hit me was, well, now we don't have any of those validation rules at this second layer. The cool thing about Lightning and, cryptographically connected second layers to Bitcoin is that, they're actually doing their own types of validation that tend to also ensure that you're not creating Bitcoin out of thin air. But with these centralized providers, they're black boxes. There is no validation. You don't know what they're doing behind the scenes. You're trusting that they're not doing any shady stuff. And so we now have a decade of history of many examples. It seems almost at least one huge hack every year or two, or just revelation that one of these large centralized custodians, in fact, does not have full backing, and in some cases, like FTX, has absolutely no backing on those coins. So what does that really mean? Well, it means that, in FTX's case, there were something like 17,000 Bitcoin that at least the users of FTX believed were a legitimate part of the Bitcoin supply. But really what had happened is FTX printed their own fake Bitcoin, which nobody noticed because they were not verifying it by withdrawing it to the safety of their own wallets.
Awesome. And that's a good segue to my next question. So I just posted in the space a tweet that Caitlin Long, she pulled a list of all of the exchanges and how much Bitcoin they lost from the article that you wrote. So was there anything that surprised or shocked you when you were putting together this list, or anything that you hadn't known before?
I had certainly known about all of those historic ones, though. I put a tweet in there that I actually just came across yesterday as I was doing research for this, in which a huge hack of Gate.io that apparently happened a few years ago and was never disclosed happened. And so I think that really hit on what I'm trying to warn people about, which is, you don't necessarily are going to know that an exchange is running as a fractional reserve for a long time. This is where it's really hard to quantify, at what specific level of fractional reserve does it become a problem? I've never operated an exchange myself, so I'm not sure exactly what the normal flows are. But it's obvious that during times of fear and panic, those flows drastically increase. And that's often what results in these exchanges that have been operating on a fractional reserve to finally have to throw up their hands and admit that they can no longer process their withdrawal requests. So the same thing happened with Gox back in the day. There were a number of red flags and warning signs, but ostensibly Gox operated for most of its existence as a fractional reserve exchange. And, this didn't come out, I think, until years later after a lot of forensic accounting was done as a part of the bankruptcy process. And, essentially it had been hacked so many different times over the years that Karpeles was basically trying to dig himself out of a hole. And unfortunately, the increasing popularity and exchange rate of Bitcoin made it harder and harder for him to dig himself out of that hole until eventually, with the run-up and all-time high in late 2013, early 2014, it just hit the point where the reserves got completely depleted and it could no longer process any of those withdrawal requests. And the curtain kind of fell. And so I think that's actually a fairly similar thing that, seems to have happened with the recent FTX drama. Of course, it was just a lot more convoluted as to, how they ended up in this fractional reserve scenario.
Well said. It's kind of like that line from The Wizard of Oz, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. In your opinion, having lived through the time of Mt. Gox and seeing FTX right now, would you consider them, say, a one-for-one comparison? Are there similarities or differences? What have you noticed?
It certainly seems like there was a lot more like maliciousness or malevolence on the FTX side of things. Of course, it's still so early that we don't know all the details. My sort of takeaway with Gox was that Carpelli's kind of got suckered into buying Gox when it was already insolvent. And whether or not he realized it at the time, I never was really clear on. But I think poor accounting practices were definitely the case at Gox. Now, you know, SBF seems to be trying to position himself in the same type of way of like, oh, we just had really bad accounting and I wasn't clear what was happening. Maybe that's true, maybe not. It seems a lot less likely given the sophistication of the FTX operation, but this is going to be a mess that is going to go on for years and years. I mean, Gox bankruptcy has been like 8 years so far, and I would not at all be surprised if FTX takes as long, if not longer, due to the additional complexity.
With that being the case, why does it take so long for these things to work out? If you're somebody that's got Bitcoin sitting in an account at FTX, what are you expecting to take place?
The problem, you know, seems to be unraveling just where the money went and who is actually owed what. You know, one of the reasons why the Gox bankruptcy took so long was due to a lawsuit by Peter Vicini's CoinLab. Essentially, they were in position to have this contractual relationship to kind of be like the American entity or American arm of Gox back in the day. And so they had some legal claims that, I mean, most people felt were flimsy, but you know, they did exist. There were some contracts that happened. And so, you know, essentially what happens in any of these cases is that you've got a ton of creditors that are rightfully owed money, and they're not going to walk away assuming it's a non-trivial amount of money. They're going to try to get as much of their money back. And so essentially, you're going to have a case where, you know, with FTX, it looks like it may be a million people are coming out of the woodwork and all saying, no, I want my slice of the pie. And the complexity of their claims may vary significantly because, you know, I'm sure there's a lot more relationships in this latest blow up than just simple exchange customers. You know, we know there are plenty of corporations, startups that were invested in and you know, perhaps somewhat strong armed into putting their corporate treasuries into this scheme. So, you know, it seems like it's going to be an order of magnitude more complexity, you know, both due to the complex corporate structure that Alameda and FTX had with, I think, like 100 different entities, and also the just much wider variety of creditors that are going to be involved.
That's a really good point. And there's also the distinction of FTX being a more sophisticated firm. One of the forms of fake Bitcoin that you mentioned in the article that we haven't touched on yet, we don't have to spend a whole lot of time here because it gets really complicated really quick, is derivatives, futures, and options. So if you could maybe explain a little bit as to why these contracts could suffice as fake Bitcoin.
Yeah, and I'm, you know, I'm not a trader, so I couldn't even explain to you very well, you know, how you know, options or futures trading actually works under the hood, other than to say that at least in the case of futures, you can have cash settled futures or you can have, you know, actual asset settled futures, and it seems like cash settled is, you know, 99% of what happens. So, you know, when I mentioned, you know, these are essentially fiat markets, the market itself in no way is built upon a foundation of these assets that are being traded, you know, actually existing anywhere between the counterparties that are trading them. That's why it's called, you know, paper Bitcoin or paper gold or whatever. It's essentially sophisticated accounting and financial gambling strategies. So from that perspective, because you don't have to actually acquire the asset in order to sell it, you know, you can just, you know, create these entries for, you know, arbitrary units of the asset and then start trading it. And as long as you end up settling in cash, following the rules of these contracts, everybody walks away happy. But it can get weird because, you know, you can artificially inflate the volumes of what's being traded. And what has happened in a number of cases over the years is these large firms have actually been found to basically push the price in one direction or another by spoofing orders. And spoofing basically means, you know, creating a bunch of orders that you have no intention of actually fulfilling. And I guess you could best describe it as kind of like bullying the market, you know, because other traders that are participating in a market, they're going to be looking at the order books. They're going to be, you know, looking at, you know, what the other traders are doing. And in some cases, if it looks like a whale is coming for you, you know, you might run away, so to speak, in the market. And that's kind of how these large firms can push the price of assets on these paper markets around, because they can throw their fiat weight around.
That's a good point. And speaking of throwing weight around, one of the issues that you talk about in the article is the tangible commodity of gold and precious metals being an instance where we see this similar dynamic take place. How does what you've observed with Bitcoin differ from what you've observed with other commodities, or is it really more similar than different?
As far as I can tell, the similarities are there. You know, the options in the futures markets seem to operate the same way. It's just they're still so new and immature that the size of the markets is still relatively small in comparison to, you know, the size of the like spot Bitcoin market, which is, you know, based upon trading, hopefully, you know, supposedly the actual asset. Once again, you know, things can get weird if, say, you're trading all of these paper markets and they get blown up to the size that you're doing, you know, an order of magnitude more trading of the asset than actually really exists. I think that was basically what happened with the credit default swap market, you know, resulting in the great financial crisis back in 2008, is that you're essentially building, you know, castles in the air. You know, there's no foundation for them, or the foundation that they're built upon is actually infinitesimally small compared to what you've built. And, you know, people are trading back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, until eventually somebody realizes that there's no foundation. And then, you know, there's a massive panic and the whole scheme falls apart. So I guess from a like historical standpoint, you know, we walk through all of these different examples of fake Bitcoin, and, you know, Bitcoin weathered the fork coin wars. We're currently in the sort of IOU problem stage, and looking at paper contracts, you know, futures, derivatives, whatever, that is, I would say, more of the forward-looking warning of, you know, we've already seen this happen in other markets. This is something that we should be keeping our eye on. And of course, the obvious question is, well, what do we do about it? And, you know, we can't stop people from trading and making up unbacked tokens, but we can try to limit it. And that's where I think the big difference between Bitcoin and other commodities is that one of the reasons for, you know, paper traded commodities to get so big is that it is convenient. Very few of these traders want to even have to worry about having to physically take delivery of, you know, a tanker of oil, for example. But with Bitcoin, that's not really much of an issue. Like, you don't really have a good excuse not to take delivery of Bitcoin. The level of friction required to do that is close to zero, you know, once you actually just know how a Bitcoin wallet works. So, you know, I think if we have more pressure on people to be building these markets as being, you know, Bitcoin settled markets rather than cash settled markets, that will help. Also, if we actually could get a spot ETF, that would hopefully, you know, take away some of the demand for the cash settled, you know, paper contracts. But in general, for me, it's just about limiting the magnitude of how big some of these fake Bitcoin markets can get. And the way that you do that is you give as little Bitcoin as possible for people to, you know, base their fractional reserve schemes on, because, you know, they generally still need to have some reserves, especially in the like spot crypto exchange casinos.
That's an excellent point. And so we're getting ready to open up Q&A if anybody has something they want to ask on this subject. But you kind of brought up an interesting thought. This is Twitter Spaces and we're doing it live. So do you think that there will ever be stable credit when it comes to Bitcoin related transactions, as in you could take out a loan and denominate it in Bitcoin and we would have some stability in the market?
Well, a Bitcoin denominated loan in terms of needing to pay back something in Bitcoin terms would probably be pretty tough until Bitcoin becomes a unit of account. But, you know, there are already many different loan products out there. Now, the vast majority of them are, you know, rehypothecation schemes, and that's what has been revealed over, you know, the course of this year, really, is that the rehypothecation doesn't end necessarily after one step. You know, it can kind of hop around multiple times, creating more and more leverage, to the point that, you know, you've created essentially a highly unstable system, and then you have to figure out, you know, where is the actual money and who owes who what. And that's kind of where we are right now. But, you know, there are what I would consider to be some safer lending options out there. I think HODL supports it. I think Unchained supports it. There's probably a couple others that I'm not aware of, but, you know, essentially, you know, creating multi-sig contracts where, you know, you're creating a multi-party multi-sig amongst the lenders and you know, both the creditors and the debtors, and, you know, essentially locking up those coins and making sure that they don't get rehypothecated. I think the value of that has been lost on most people. It's a tricky thing to really say that we have a practical solution for, because the nature of these instruments is that rehypothecating assets is more profitable. You know, it's higher risk, it's higher yield, and, you know, the average person is going to, if they're shopping around for loans, they're going to look for what appears to be the most tantalizing rates, whether that's the yield that they're earning or the interest that they're paying. And so I think most people will just gravitate to whatever looks like the best thing, and they won't even necessarily know that their risk profiles are different. So that's something I don't have a great solution for right now. I'm not sure if there is one. is that there are some perverse incentives at play.
That's an interesting question. You brought up the debate over a spot ETF and how various participants in the market are waiting on that. Are there any risks associated with, say, a spot ETF or a close-end fund that you would be uncomfortable with, or how would that differ from, say, holding Bitcoin with your own keys?
Yeah, I mean, I think the best example is GBTC, which, you know, I've been a fan of, you know, for my retirement portfolio for a number of years, but it doesn't track the spot price because, once again, it is a completely disconnected market. I mean, it's not completely disconnected, right? There are, at times, you know, sometimes, for certain people, ways to redeem the underlying asset. But it's for all intents and purposes, for most practical investors, it's a disconnected market. And so that's why, we've seen premiums, I think, over 100% during bull markets when all the retail folks were trying to buy Bitcoin through their brokerages. And that was, you know, the primary financial exposure they could get. And then now we're at this like negative 40% discount as a result of, you know, a lot of the shenanigans that have been going on and various entities that were basically trying to arbitrage that premium. It's tricky. Very few people, I think, understand the complex nature of these different quote unquote Bitcoin assets. And the SEC certainly hasn't helped. I actually had a blog post a few years ago in which I took my retirement account funds that were in GBTC and I said, you know, I don't like having to deal with the premium and discount that I don't really have any understanding of why it's doing what it's doing. I just want, you know, an actual one-to-one Bitcoin ETF. And what happened was there was this Swedish ETN that was launched, and my broker added so that I had access to it. So I essentially sold my GBTC and I bought this Swedish ETN that was, actual like one-to-one backed ETN. So they would adjust their Bitcoin holdings, I think, on a daily basis to make sure that it was a near perfect match to the exchange rate. And that was all good and well for about 6 months until the SEC published a notice that basically said, you know, we believe this ETN is not following some rule. I don't even remember what, but immediately when the SEC published that notice, all of the OTC QX market, and then as a result, all of the brokers that were accessing that market essentially blacklisted it, and I was frozen out of the ability to trade it. Like, I couldn't even sell it. I think it was almost 9 months later when I finally got my broker to hook me up with an international trading desk where I had to literally pick up the phone and have this hour-long conversation with someone who had access to the Swedish exchange where, you know, this ETN was natively traded, and we were able to, you know, transfer my OTCQX market ETN shares over there and actually do the trade. And I mean, it was a really annoying experience that almost resulted in a calamity where almost ended up selling for like a quarter of the actual exchange rate because all of the price tickers had been frozen for a year, and there was this, you know, Swedish kroner to dollar exchange rate issue. So suffice to say, the SEC has made my life harder in a number of different ways over the years, and that was just one of them.
Thank you. That's an excellent point. And so if you're, say, an everyday Bitcoin investor, what would be the best way to just bypass all of this and completely exit this fake Bitcoin Fugazi and just hold some real sats?
Well, I mean, there's no shortage of places where you can buy Bitcoin these days. I think the most important thing is that you have a well-vetted and robust cold storage solution. You know, assuming that you're buying, you know, non-trivial quantities of Bitcoin and you need something a bit more secure than a hot wallet, then you just need to make sure you've got that set up and, you know, have your withdrawal address whitelisted on whatever exchange you're making your purchases and withdraw as soon as possible. There's very little need to leave the Bitcoin on exchange if you're making a, you know, medium to long-term investment.
Excellent. All righty. And those were the questions that we had, and that's all we have time for today. Thank you, everyone, for sitting in on this space. And feel free to check out Jameson's article, or you can find it at blog.keys.casa. And stay safe in these bear market times and withdraw from exchanges. And we'll see you on the other side. Everyone, take care.